And good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. In the World Bank's most recent report on women, business and the law in 2021, one of the main findings was that on average, women have just 3/4 of the legal rights afforded to men. Now, discriminatory laws, particularly family law, underpin the unequal treatment of women in society. And so one of the pathways to achieving gender equality is through family law reform. Joining me on the show to discuss this further is Zarin Zafril. She's the executive director of Musawa, which is a global movement for equality and justice in the Muslim family and in family law. Zarin, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's good of you to be here. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
It's a big topic, so I thought we could start with better understanding where some of the inequalities are. So let's look at what it means when we say there are discriminatory law, particularly family law, that lead to the unequal treatment of women. Can you help us understand some of the gender-based inequalities that exist in family systems, not just in Malaysia, but around the world?
Sure. Happy to do that.
Thank you.
So I'll give you an example close to home first. So I'll give you an example in Malaysia. In Malaysia, the federal constitution states that the minimum age of marriage is 18 for both boys and girls. Mm-hmm. And that sex with underage girls, so 16 and below, is considered statutory rape with or without their consent. However, state laws allow child marriage to continue to occur in Malaysia. And a lot of the child marriage cases in Malaysia, from 2016 to 2021, more than 8,000 child marriages were reported, of which 90% were girls. Yeah, so that is in Malaysia. In Kenya, for example, there is a growing case, an issue around division of matrimonial property upon the event of divorce, where the courts awarded 80% of the value of the shared matrimonial property to the husband because they did not recognize unpaid domestic care work performed by the wife to get share of that property.
Okay.
You know, and in Latin America, there is this practice that is happening. It's called the parental alienation syndrome.
Oh,
it's called PAS, where children are forced to continue relations with parents or their fathers, even in the case of domestic violence in the family. And that is because the fathers are using the argument in courts that, the wife is creating a claim, an unsound claim, etc., to separate me from the child. Mm. So even though the children themselves have said they do not want these relations, the courts are allowing this to happen.
Okay.
So those are some of the
examples. So those are the examples of discriminatory family law. And there is a global campaign to achieve equality in family law. Can we talk a little bit about this?
Yes.
Tell us about the global campaign and why it is necessary now.
Sure. So the Global Campaign for Equality in Family Law was launched in March 2020.
At the start of the pandemic,
yes. And it was led by a group of eight member of a coordination team or a committee, we call it, where Musawa was one of them.
Okay.
Yeah. And the global campaign really is a concerted effort and a strategic effort to call on states to reform discriminatory laws, policies and practices in order to realize equality in the family, regardless of race, religion, tradition, and culture.
Mm.
Yeah. You see, Melissa, family is the most basic form of society. It's a basic form of organizational unit. And our belief is that if you can't achieve equality in the most basic form of society, how are you going to achieve equality in society or in a nation as a whole? So that's why, you know, the focus is on family. In fact, a comprehensive cross-country study conducted in 2018 called, and I have to read this, Gender Discriminatory Laws and Women's Economic Agency in Social Politics. It was concluded that egalitarian reform of family law may be the most crucial precondition for empowering women economically. I'll give you again a local example, you know, as Malaysians. So we have in Malaysia women retail operators, and they do a fantastic job. You know, these women are meticulous, they have the energy, they have the innovation, they have all the ideas. When it comes to cash management, they believe some of these women actually do fall short in terms of managing their inventories and paying certain deposits simply because they believe that they must set up a joint account with their husbands. Otherwise, it's disobedience. And it is not their place to question if the husbands withdraw from the account. So you can have what it appears to be economic empowerment of a woman, but within the private sphere, it's a very different ballgame again. And then you would see the impact and the consequence of those inequalities in the family. Men being head of households, women have to listen to them, and then that will translate to kind of erosion in the economic life.
Okay, so using that perhaps as an example, help me understand how reform of the law comes into play. How can, you know, and the campaign pushing for reform of discriminatory family law, how does that actually help empower those women?
Okay, great question. So I'll refer back to another article in 2010. So this is research done a long time ago. On when do governments promote women's rights? So why laws? Gender-related policies, including family laws, can enable women's access to employment opportunities, education, their ability to care for their families unhindered without fear. And increase their chances to escape poverty, violence, and enjoy good health. Laws and policies that promote gender equality and justice is the first step, Melissa, towards achieving gender equality in society. So think about wearing seatbelts, right? So the government or the society doesn't think, oh, you know, yeah, we should wear seatbelts, let's do a campaign about it, let's create awareness, let's do posters, etc. No, the government goes, you don't wear your seatbelts, you will be fined. And that will slowly drive the mindsets of the population towards, you know, wearing that. So similarly for laws, for family law reform. So in order for us to actually shift mindsets of society, in order for us to garner the will, the strength, the intellectual capacities of folks, you know, working towards equality in the family, the anchor will be laws.
Okay. Just to follow up on that, are there instances where the law has changed and there is reform of discriminatory laws, but it's the social norms and cultural practices that cause for some of the inequalities to persist?
Yes.
Okay.
So laws, so reforming laws isn't the it all and end all.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's the start.
The start.
So I'll give you an example. In Morocco, I think it was back in 2004, it was a trademark law reform on personal status laws. And that's the Muadana, right? And that is the law that set itself far apart from its peers, Muslim majority countries around the world, where it actually put women on equal footing with men. If I go back to child marriage again, so the Muwadana back in 2004 pretty much raised the minimum age of marriage for to 18 for both boys and girls. But in 2019, we saw that there were 32,000 applications for child marriages, of which 81% were approved. So again, enforcement of the law, training of mindsets, of judges, you know, of lawyers, of society at large, you know, is really important.
Okay. I want to come to all of that because I think it's important to talk about the stakeholders and all the different people, the different ways we can change mindset. But can I come back to the Morocco case?
Yes.
What were some of the ways in which this important reform came about? Can we learn something from the fact that they pushed through such a landmark reform?
Yes. So for the Morocco case, it was spearheaded by the head of state himself.
Oh, okay. Comes right from the top.
It comes right from the top. So women's groups were already mobilized and were already pushing for these reforms. So it's not anything new. But of course, there was the fear of Islamophobia, the fear of Morocco being, I guess, labeled at the point in time, you know, Islamic terrorism, etc., you know, state, was one of that that gave the impetus to the head of state to say, no, okay, I need to demonstrate to the world that Morocco is for both men and women. So egalitarian reforms need to come in the way.
Okay. The interesting point there is the religion as a perspective, right? Mm. So when we talk about reforming family law, has there been much progress when it comes to talking about it from the framework of a religious framework? Has there been much progress? Has it been difficult to talk about it from a religious framework?
So under the global campaign, we do look at religion, but also customs, customary laws as well, especially when we think about the Africa continent. Yeah. So of course, when it comes to changing laws that are based on religion, there is a lot of pushback and there is resistance around it. But the resistance comes from lack of understanding, an unwillingness to change for fear of what that change actually means to their own personal religious beliefs. Yeah. But there has been a lot of scholarship, a lot of research by academia to support changes in these laws that are based on religion. Case in point is in Indonesia, the Congress Ulama Perempuan Indonesia themselves. So this is a group of women in the pesantren who've come together and looked at laws and come up with their own fatwas to basically say to raise the minimum age of marriage to 19.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's 19. It's 19 in Indonesia. So, and they use, references to the Quran and the Sunnah, you know, to come up with these rulings and justifications as to why that is the case. Mm-hmm. So we do see positive developments with respect to family laws based on religious scriptures and context as well.
What about in a Malaysian context?
So I think in the Malaysian context, we have seen some changes. So I think the anti-sexual harassment law that has come to effect does look into some areas of that, although marital rape is still silent in that law. I think in Malaysia, there is, I wouldn't want to believe that there is an interest or a call for change, but the issue isn't necessarily about religious authorities per se, but it's also the complexities of our different legal system, federal versus state. It's about the convoluting mixed jurisdiction between which ministries have got which authority, you know, to have a say in those areas.
So it boils down to more structural issues. Does it mean that to tackle the issue of family law reform, we have to relook at some of the, I mean, it feels like it's too big of a problem to tackle. How do we feasibly look to for possible solutions to move ahead with family law reform, bearing in mind that there are a lot of structural barriers in Malaysia?
So we're lucky. I say that, of course, with a pinch of salt. But we are lucky in the sense that in the last quarter of the 20th century, we have seen an explosion of international advocacy for change.
Okay.
Yeah. And it does talk about structural reform. It does address religion. It does address customary. So there's a lot of rich research, academic work, scholarship around this area. We've also seen global agreements being signed by the heads of state. So the states ratified CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, right? Albeit some with reservations. But states have also pledged their commitment towards gender equality at the Beijing Platform for Action.
Right.
And sustainable development goals, Melissa, are embedded into annual budgets by the governments as well. And SDG 5, which focuses on gender equality, you know, is a focus area. And specifically, indicator 5.1.1 talks about identifying family law as one of the legal frameworks.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
that must be
reformed.
So
it's actually specifically mentioned.
It's specific. Yes. So we are in a state, we are in a position where women's groups and grassroots organization are collecting lived reality stories to be able to kind of pinpoint where those discriminatory laws, policies and practices rely.
Okay.
You have international bodies that kind of laid out, okay, kind of like a blueprint as to how you get from point A to point B. Yeah. And then they also we also have data. Right? Now, the issue, and I think governments and states do recognize and understand the need to embark on these reforms. But what is needed is political leadership, really, yeah, to pull organizations together, to have consultations, to have discourses, meetings, to talk about, okay, let's look at these issues and see what needs to be done. But it's also collaboration and cooperation across ministries and agencies.
Are you seeing that, Zarin? Based on your observations, are you seeing this political leadership that you speak of?
I do in a sense of, willingness to talk to women's groups and women's organizations. So I do see that in Malaysia, but I think going out to with respect to the global campaign in other countries, of course, countries like Sudan that, you know, is just thrusted right in the middle of war, you know, that's clearly not happening. Yeah, so there is momentum and there is wanting to cross learn and there is wanting to change, but in Malaysia, particularly at this point in time with the political, I guess, climate that we're in, I think everyone's kind of treading very carefully as to what they can do and what they can't.
Okay, so we have the women's groups who are collecting lived realities. We have the international advocacy coming from externally. We hope to see political leadership coming from the top. The middle bracket where there's a gap, the other stakeholders that you mentioned, the people in the justice system, the judges, the legal professionals, administrators, scholars, religious scholars, how do they all kind of play a part in to what we hope to see, which is reform of family law?
So judges and lawyers clearly play a big part. In Musawa, for example, Melissa, we actually do conduct what we call capacity building training sessions for judges and lawyers. In fact, we did one about 2 years ago for Palestine. Yeah, and I think it's not a an easy thing in the sense that, you know, you have one training and you think they're bought over. No,
right.
Clearly that's not
the case.
It
has to be continuous.
It is continuous. It's a dialogue. Mm. It's a dialogue and it's a conversation. Last year we trained a few lawyers from the Legal Aid Society of Pakistan about division of matrimonial property and assets. And we took the examples of Singapore and Malaysia and how the formula, you know, is being derived and how they can apply. And as a result, there were 80 submissions to the courts that they filed in support of these wives to claim for better property distribution.
Okay, so there's an impact from the training. You can see it happening in real life. That's fantastic news. With this campaign, is the point then to get the word out more, to create more awareness, so people are aware that, oh, actually there are some discriminatory laws that
family
apply to me? Okay.
Yes. So the campaign really has three objectives.
Okay.
Yeah. The first, you know, as you cleverly put it, is to get the word out there. It is to make family law reform a global priority issue. It is to put it on the agenda. Yeah. Conferences, meetings. If you think about children's essays or art competition, even to that level, right, is to have that discourse and conversation going. The second is to strengthen regional networks that are working on family law reform, because there are movements happening, but they're all pockets and small pockets. But the minute, you know, there's a climate crisis or there's an economic downturn, then priorities get, you know, pushed aside. The final thing is for us to kind of amplify the work of national groups. There are astounding and amazing changes and impact that, you know, these women
right.
with not much resources, just five of them, you know, that are causing and making tidal wave of change.
Wow.
Yeah, in that area. And we want to amplify that a little bit more at the global scale. Why? Is to so that A, we get the conversations going. B, so that the state takes them seriously to bring them to the table.
Mm.
We need to have that dialogue. We need to have that discussion, because you can't, Melissa, you can't have a prosperous society socially, economically, if at the home the woman is subordinate to the husband, or the husband feels that he has no choice but to break back because his wife can't work and support him in supporting the family. So,
okay. So for the people watching tonight, Zarin, you mentioned the need and the desire to get conversations out, but it should be the right the right narratives. What do you hope to see Malaysians talk about? At a public level, what is it that you're hoping through this campaign Malaysians start talking more about, specific to Malaysian context?
Okay. So this week, Melissa, we are launching the global campaign Week of Action. And we are launching our website on the global campaign. And it's a platform for fellow Malaysians as well to come in and to understand and to learn what's happening in other parts of the world pertaining to the family.
Mm.
What's important, so the conversations that need to happen out there, which the platform will support, and we will be opening up membership as well for organizations, communities, collectives, you know, who are working on family law reform or who want to understand and to learn more about it, to join. But the whole intention is that if the society shifts its mindset to accept and acknowledge that you can't have equality in society without equality in the family, you can't achieve economic prosperity if the gender equality is completely off balance. So that's the conversation we need to have. And the fact that, look, let's look at our laws and compare them to lived realities. Mm. The lived realities of both women and men are important to inform whether our laws are relevant, whether our laws are fair, whether our laws are just or not.
Right.
So that's the conversation I hope, you know, we will have.
Zarin, thank you so much for being on the show today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, no, thank you so much, Melissa.
That was my conversation with Zarin Zafriel from Musawa, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night. We'll be right back.